This is a continuation of a story entitled Why Trees by Hannah Gold from Harper's Magazine, March 2025. Is that why you make movies? Quote, for me, film goes both ways. I devise my vision of alienation, and it brings me into contact with other people, many of whom I enjoy very much, end quote. Quote, ah, well, in that case, what was the idea you wanted to talk about, end quote. Quote, what I propose is a feature film based on the myth of Bacchus and Philemon. Has this ever been done? I think that possibly, unbelievably, it has not. And now, what Goddard did for the Odyssey, what Shyama did for Eurydice, I want to do for these two old people who did not recognize the gods when they showed up at their door, but welcomed them in anyway. I want to uncover new dimensions, place the story in a new context, create new psychologies. Of course, we all know what happens to Bacchus and Philemon, and the lesson we're supposed to learn. Every schoolchild knows, end quote. Quote, they like burn to death, right? In a fire, end quote. Quote, Laura, no. All their neighbors die in a flood devised by the gods who are disappointed in them and, frankly, a bit insecure. But Bacchus and Philemon get turned into trees. Why? Actually, that's my first agenda item, end quote. The director retrieved a miniature notepad from his shirt pocket and began turning the pages with his right pinky. Quote, what is, end quote. Quote, I have it here written down. Item 1, discuss with Laura, why trees, end quote. Laura had pulled up Ovid's Metamorphosis on her phone, finding that the veil obscured her vision less when she stared up close at the object than generated its own light. Quote, it says here, she said, paraphrasing, that Bacchus and Philemon were a poor, elderly couple, and yet when the gods Jupiter and Mercury showed up at their door disguised as beggars, they lavished them with all the hospitality they could muster. The gods revealed themselves to the couple and led them to a hill, where they watched their neighbors, who had all shut their doors against the strangers, drown. Bacchus and Philemon were rewarded with a temple, in place of their former modest dwelling. It says that the gods let them ask for anything they wanted, and what they wanted was to tend to the temple and to die at the same hour. So when death eventually came for them, the gods decided, for some reason, to turn them into trees. A linden and an oak. Sounds like a bargain for the gods, end quote. Quote, when you command such inordinate power, you get everything at a bargain. Isn't that the way of the world? Whereas the people of the country paid dearly for their moment of selfishness. The gods were disguised as strangers, as supplicants. Yes, but they went on a murderous rampage, end quote. Quote, I'd like to be a tree. Plenty of sunlight, wind on my face, quote, mused Laura as she adjusted her veil. Quote, no bank account, no more struggling along, end quote. Quote, nihilism. That's one option, I think, though that you don't become a tree because you're tired of living, end quote. No, she said, disappointed. Laura, he said with a hint of concern. Quote, I feel certain that people do not become trees by waiting around to become trees. But why trees in the first place? I don't have the answer, end quote. Laura shrugged, frustrated, yet she maintained the confidence of one who cannot be seen sweating lightly from the forehead. End quote, maybe a warning, she said after a while. Quote, meaning, end quote. Quote, for the Romans, so that whenever they leave their temples, or wherever they lived, end quote. Quote, houses, Laura, my God, end quote. Quote, whenever they leave their houses and see trees, they'll be reminded of the story. It's a lesson, end quote. quote, which is, end quote, quote, to welcome the stranger, right? Or else obliterate country, kin, and yourself, end quote. Quote, okay, interesting. That is not what I was thinking at all. My inclinations were far more agricultural. Now I am seeing the story in a whole new light. So what do you say? Do you want to work with me on this? It will take 6 months with me on this. It will take 6 months to a year to fundraise, and meanwhile we can continue these discussions on a regular basis. All of them generously compensated by me, of course, end quote. This time Laura did not hesitate. Quote, for sure, I can see myself devoting a lot of energy to this, end quote. Well, with the following weeks, several of Laura and Mark's mutual friends began to realize something was up. And who or what had tipped them off? Possibly it was Laura, operating on a minimum of sleep and crossing one bridge too many to attend several casual weekend gatherings in a state of mean intoxication, telling anyone who would listen that there was something running around the city with her exact same life. If it wasn't Laura who tipped them off, which is, it totally was, and loudly, then Mark strolling into the party with a small white-haired woman on his arm did. Either way, such bold-faced confirmation led no room for doubt, which was somehow also the exact amount of room required to encourage endless speculation among this information-saturated and intimacy-starved social set. Laura thought at first that the replicant didn't look her age, which Mark had told her in a polite and infuriatingly long email she did not respond to was 25. At that moment, drinking in the face and body of this woman with burning eyes, Laura chastised herself for failing to stalk her on the internet, find out everything about her, and build one of those psychological profiles she once prided herself on. It hadn't occurred to her to do so. She had trapped her firmly within the confines of a brief email correspondence. The replicant had represented to her a blank and, since she equated youth with beauty and beauty with her own perceived lack of it, a taunting, youthful blank. But this woman wasn't particularly beautiful. The hue of her hair wasn't indicative of youth. It gave her an ageless, elfish quality. And she was unguarded, neat, like a gleaming set of tools that might repair, adjust, and take the measure of you. Mark's eyes teemed with feelings of tenderness that fled the moment he caught sight of Laura. He felt for the arm of a couch that wasn't there and stumbled a little. He made no move to assist her, not because he didn't want to, he couldn't. After a little more than 2 weeks of his copious messages and her silence, he was stunned to discover that he was already unlearning her, that he couldn't intuit in a given moment what she wanted from him. That vivid sense of service had been his reason for staying. He had been able to give her what she wanted without knowing where the desires came from or how he recognized them. Laura had always said that wanting was better than needing, because it was a product of the imagination and the driver of all ingenuity, artistic or otherwise. But why did that make it superior to needing? Mark wanted to know. The mind inventing things to want, chasing them, letting them become elusive, like a kitten playing with a piece of string. This was all familiar to him. In fact, it was shop talk. It seemed harmless enough on the surface. Yet a life guided by this precept flashed by in moments of critical distraction and disintegration. The rind, the integument, but never the soft, vital substance they protected. He needed things he had not even begun to want. Laura had steadied her body but not her vision, which seemed to swing just above her head like a chandelier. Quote, oh no, she said, I'm way drunk for what's happening here, end quote. Quote, we can go, end quote, said Mark. Quote, there was a miscommunication. I couldn't get in touch with you. I was worried, but I understood why you wouldn't. I understand, end quote. Quote, cease and desist your understand. I am the person who has been left. So I am the person who understands. You should understand less. End quote. Quote, I have a feeling I'm about to. End quote. Quote, you are right. As righter as rain when it rains for years, no days. And I just want to say that I'm good, good, good. Don't worry just cause you see me and I'm falling down. Don't worry cause I'm all about trees now. I've been reading about the gods. That's right, the gods. They're going to come down from heaven and be quite disappointed in you, Mark. The gods will be like, what an effing joke Mark is, laughing at you in your temple where my house used to be. What I'm saying is I got a new job. It's great, I'm fine, and I need to speak with your representative, end quote. Quote, Laura, I have no idea what you're talking about, end quote. The other partygoers had begun to give the quarrelers a wide berth, as if to grant respect and privacy in this difficult time. Although really, what they created with their lower voices and oblique stances was a stage. Quote, I need to speak with your replicant, end quote. Quote, please don't call her that. It's not her name. She won't respond to it, end quote. Quote, hi, said the replicant, extending an arm and a hand toward Laura. It's so good to meet you. It's so good to meet you, end quote. Quote, what? Said Laura, you're kidding, end quote. Quote, no, really, I think we should talk like we suggested. Sorry if I wasn't clear about that in my email, end quote. Quote, you were clear, end quote. Quote, there's no time limit on this. If you want to get to know me, if you're curious, you know where to find me, end quote. Laura felt the replicant's words being drilled into her skull. Quote, because of you, I make no sense, end quote. Here, Justin, vole-like, butted in with his trademark forced laughter, quote, kind of think it's the whiskey, Laura, end quote. Quote, I'm preaching the gospel of existentialism, Justin. I'm being uprooted. That one over there is living in my temple. It's all in the Bible, end quote. Quote, what's all this about the temple, asked Mark, and the trees, was it? End quote. Quote, sorry, it's in the metamorphosis, is what I meant to say, end quote, said Laura. Quote, my bad, does anyone know whether Ovid had a last name or was Ovid his last name, end quote. Quote, I think it was just Ovid, end quote, said Mark's white-haired date. Quote, the way you're just a replicant, end quote, shot back Laura. Quote, no, my name is Laura, end quote. Quote, and my name is Laura, end quote. Quote, and your name is Laura. It's a popular name, end quote. Quote, and Mark's a popular guy, end quote, said Laura, aiming once again to pierce the wobbling knight with a clear blow against her alarmingly sober enemy. Quote, not really, end quote. Quote, no, you're right about that, end quote, said Laura, growing contemplative. Quote, he doesn't have the people skills, but then I never did either. Clearly, I need to be sleeping in the bed now. Where can I find you when I'm conscious again, end quote. Quote, end quote. Quote, you said, Laura, and you said, you know where to find me, end quote. Quote, I do administrative work at the Natural History Museum Sunday through Thursday. Just drop by. I can pretty much always take a break. Come tomorrow. I'd literally have nothing going on, end quote. Quote, you work at the Natural History Museum, end quote, said Laura, as if every word were a hurdle she was taking her sweet time stepping over. Quote, the American Museum of Natural History, end quote. No more than 16 hours later, Laura found herself staring up at the massive stone steps of the museum. She had taken a cab home, slept, absorbed 5 alcoholic beverages into the fabric of her being, eaten a soft pretzel, and drunk a Snapple purchased from a street vendor. Laura called the woman, she was trying to be charitable and phrase out addressing her as a replicant, who was only too free, but was around the corner at the planetarium. Quote, "It's a lot brighter over here," end quote, the woman advised cheerfully. Much of the building was made of glass, and the sun poured through it. Quote, "Good for the days that arrive after long nights," end quote. Sure, thought Laura, if you want your head to explode. They met along the perimeter of the Big Bang exhibit. A single-file line of visitors was making its way through it at the excruciating pace. Billions of years flew by with every step, and they didn't want to miss anything. Quote, "I see you don't work in the sharks department," said Laura. Quote, "Too bad." Quote, "Pardon?" Quote, "There are all these pamphlets and signs in the main lobby for the museum's special exhibit on sharks. The slogan was, 'To be great, it is to be misunderstood.' Pretty compelling, given the subject matter." Quote, "Oh, yeah, you write ad copy, don't you?" Quote, "I do. It's not my true calling to stand back and admire the handiwork of museum signage, but it's a living. I swim with the sharks," end quote. The woman took a step toward Laura, who was squinting into the sun. Quote, "I'm more interested in your kind, to be honest," end quote. They went through an unmarked door into a looping administrative corridor that contained nothing but filing cabinets and vending machines. Laura soberly examined this woman whose existence had so rudely ripped her from slumber many a night. As they continued their small talk, Laura noticed that the woman had a way with people that was frank and intuitive. It was a bedside manner for the wide awake, or whoever had the need of it. This woman was nothing like Laura. Nonetheless, Laura was on guard for the essential thing they surely must share, whatever it was that compelled the woman to follow in her footsteps, to covet, then co-opt her life. Quote, "I don't want to give up on Mark," blurted Laura suddenly, but not passionately. Quote, "I don't want you to, Laura. I've never wanted that," end quote. The woman was very cool, but not inert. This seemed to be the conversation she most wished to have. Quote, "I want you to give him up, though," end quote. Quote, "I see. It causes you pain that, quote, "It doesn't cause me pain," interrupted Laura. Quote, "All right, well, I'm not giving him up," quote, said the woman. Quote, "But I was there first," end quote. Quote, "You weren't first. We're adults. It's too late for that." "But, okay, by your logic, the holy sequence of events, maybe I'm second. Or maybe you are. Maybe time is running backward," end quote, the woman proclaimed with an insolent flourish. Laura thought spending too much time around the Big Bang exhibit was detrimental to her hardening 25-year-old brain. Quote, "You'd have to be nuts not to think that," end quote. Quote, "Let's just refrain from talking about the hard knocks of life and who has a right to love whom as if we're all standing in one long cosmic line. It's all I'm saying," end quote. Quote, "Fine, have it your way, but I do love Mark," end quote. Quote, "Okay, so talk to Mark about Mark. He says you don't call and he's worried about you. He's worried about you going through life without the shearling slippers you left at his place, and, frankly, he's worried about you wandering the streets in no shoes at all. Laura, I don't know you well, but sometimes it's as if I'm dating your mother," end quote. Quote, "I wear shoes. Tell him I wear shoes. The kind that can stand up to city streets and snow," end quote. Quote, "Tell him yourself," end quote. Quote, "Okay," said Laura, slumping down into one of the chairs. "Okay," end quote. The woman had been seated for some time. Quote, I read a poem of yours this afternoon, quote, said Laura. Quote, I went online and looked you up, end quote. Quote, which one? Quote, it was called Human Head in Fishbowl, end quote. And quote, what do you think? Well, the title was misleading. I also heard you do some activism in your apartment, end quote. Quote, on Earth we call it tenant organization, end quote. Quote, well, a conference room in the planetarium feels like neutral ground, end quote. Quote, between what and what, end quote. Quote, between Earth and, you know, end quote. Laura gestured wildly with her hands. The big mystery of it all. The omega, the bang, the infinite something above our or, and below our heads that's taking forever to curl up into nothingness, end quote. Quote, and here I thought you were just mocking me, end quote. Well, I sort of was, sorry, end quote. It dawned on Laura that she really was sorry. She was growing fond of this woman. Her persistence, her consoling streak, her argumentative streak. Perhaps one day, months or years from now, the woman's existence would cease to torment her. Quote, actually, Laura found herself saying, I think I admire what you do, in theory at least. I'd like to do something like that myself someday, end quote. Laura wasn't sure if she meant it, but it seemed to give the woman a certain license. She spoke earnestly to Laura about her life for a long time, her despondency, her credulities, her joys. There was no wonderful slogan, perfectly articulated platform, or sense of righteousness held out too firmly it would bring about the world she wanted. But here was this world, and somehow she was trying to catch its eye, to hold its gaze a little longer each time. Belief, she decided, was what she was after, to believe in as much of the world as she could. Mach's trusting smile, the senselessness of fate, the drift of the stars, and the price of love. Six months passed, and then a year. The director had raised the necessary funds and was several weeks into a new health regime that prohibited all exercise yet demanded that he remain standing for as much of the day as possible. This required incredible amounts of cold coffee. He was walking, talking, stimulant soup, and looked better than ever. Quote, the secret is my own blood, end quote, he liked to blurt out. Quote, these days it mostly pools in my legs and feet, but nobody can tell, end quote. The first day of filming was the high point of this creative venture, which, while not exactly arduous, had up until then taken many confounding turns. Laura, never wavering in her commitment to follow the director through his labyrinth process, still privately considered a few of his sharp turns to have been inadvisable. At the top of her list were the 2 months they had wasted trying to adapt Bassus and Philemon into a movie musical. It was to be a magnificent number, with the townspeople in matching spandex outfits bitchily slamming their doors in unison to an ever-swelling melody. The angle they'd settle on was much more achievable in terms of budget and scale, and a better match for Laura's own writerly sensibility. It would be a modern interpretation, no music. Bassus and Philemon are living off Social Security in an illegal basement apartment in Sunnyside, Queens. Philemon was laid off 6 months ago from the local paper where she had worked for 50 years as a city hall reporter, during which time Bassus cultivated herself as an eccentric, first fortune-telling, then designing wearable art, then straight-up hoarding. There isn't a takeout box or magazine that passes through her doorway that she doesn't try to repurpose as a belt or a hat. The ceiling leaks. The rent is impossible to scrape together, but so are thoughts of leaving. They're content with each other and at the same time utterly lonely, since nobody, not even the delivery workers, not even the woman who faces like fresh produce and canvasses the city comptroller, can bear to cross their threshold. Bossus is hard at work crafting a small, companionable dog out of a week's worth of I Am New York's when two miserable-looking individuals dressed in togas knock on the door and ask if they can come in for a bit of a lie-down. So far, these two troublesome and filthy strangers haven't found any takers, but Bossus and Philemon welcome them. No questions asked. Later, after the rest of the city's inhabitants have been wiped out by a colossal storm, Bossus and Philemon issue their request to the gods and are granted first a floor through loft in Chinatown. Their lives become incredibly chic. But there's no one left in the city for them to share their good fortune with. Occasionally, the gods stop by, blast some ABBA, go on Elysian benders that leave no residue of human suffering, and complain about their terrible kids, who are going to live forever. In the film's final scene, Bossus and Philemon undergo their ultimate transformation. Philemon is reading Alberto Moravia's novel while Bossus pours them two bowls of grape nuts, courtesy of the gods, for breakfast. She tries shuffling to the fridge for dairy-free milk and almost falls over. Her feet are rooted to the ground. Philemon, his back to her, is frantically knocking over tables and chairs as his legs turn to wood. The change takes hold rather slowly, allowing time for physical comedy and dialogue. Quote, "I am a pious woman," wails Bacchus. "I always try to have faith, but oh, that it has come to this, to see every neighbor washed away and have nobody to invite over to our gorgeous apartment, and then, on top of that, to be turned into trees. Philemon, you're eerily quiet. Are you even listening? Don't you have anything to say?" End quote. Quote, "I'm struggling," says Philemon. Quote, "And if a tree should shrug in the forest," end quote. Quote, "What forest? We're downtown," end quote. Quote, "I wish I could see your face," end quote. Quote, "I'm glad you can't. It would be too much for me just now," end quote. Quote, "But there is no later. Oh, Philemon, just answer me this. Why is this happening to us?" end quote. Quote, "We asked to die at the same time. In retrospect, I might have amended that request, but the gods probably thought we were giving us a real treat. They're a lot older than us, you know. I wouldn't put it past them to have outmoded concepts about what people are into these days," end quote. It went on like that for a while, with sulky French camera work and borscht belt delivery. The director had rehired that same young woman, Sophie, to handle the coffee and lunch orders. She was running every which way, blowing on his coffee and wielding a clipboard. Laura respected her near-athletic ability to feign having a lot on her plate at any given moment. After work, she and Sophie went to a nearby dive bar. It was mobbed with Christmas lights. Laura wondered how often they had held poetry readings. The laminated menu taped to the wall was stocked with the usual cheap alcoholic concoctions, plus the occasional witticism and curiosity. The each got a Helen's face. It was a pineapple something. Sophie hadn't changed much, or at least the first impression she'd made had yet to dissipate. The red hair and deadpan delivery, her presence here in this bar, a facsimile of every bar Laura had frequented in her 20s, served as a portal back to a period Laura could remember but no longer touch. The scenery was familiarly arranged, but dreams, sensations, and illusions had vanished. She no longer looked at this woman and imagined what she herself had been and might become. Instead, Laura saw a woman, a relative stranger, whose flagrant presumptions had unwittingly changed the course of her own life, or perhaps only hastened that change. And she saw that whatever she, Laura, would become next was anyone's guess. For now, she was tired, going weeks without talking to anyone who wasn't her boss, returning from marathon brainstorming sessions to the modest apartment that never accommodated visitors, and collapsing at the end of the day from the work she threw herself into with frantic diligence and tempered bitterness. She had taken the works in progress out of her desk and placed them on the floor of her closet to be trampled on by empty shoes. It was obvious to her now that someone else had written them. Meanwhile, she was working more hours than ever for the ad agency and the director. Sophie grimaced at the sweetness of the drink and then sucked it all down. Quote, "Something else next, yes?" End quote. The conversation felt carefree despite the lack of intimacy between them, like a cold reading of a script that sends the actors into fits of giggles. Laura even managed, without much effort, to ask Sophie if she'd seen Mark and his girlfriend around. Quote, "Other Laura?" End quote, Sophie asked kindly. Quote, "They're not really in my crowd. More adjacent to it. Yes, I saw them, but only once." End quote. Quote, "I haven't seen him in almost a year. Either of them." End quote. Quote, "Does that mean you've met her?" End quote. Quote, "Once or twice when I was first found out, but where did you see them? How did they seem?" End quote. Quote, "Like two assholes in love. We were in the woods, so that was probably enhancing the effect. People suffering extreme emotional states can so easily fly under the radar in this city, don't you find?" End quote. Quote, "I'm living proof of it. Perhaps I should pour myself out into a glen someday. But how did you come to discover them in the woods?" End quote. Quote, "A retreat of sorts. It was organized by this collective I'm part of, and so are they. I hadn't realized Mark joined until I saw him there. The group is decentralized, totally offline. I'm sure there are more of us in this city than anywhere else, but the larger East Coast meetings happen upstate. It's funny. You show up and half the attendees are brushing phantom ticks off their fitted trees, and the other half come prepared not merely to pass the night in a great outdoors, but for Armageddon itself. Everyone wears black, regardless." End quote. Laura laughed, carried away by the strangeness of this world Sophie was building, picturing her ex-boyfriend who once read The Atlantic with genuine concern, sitting in a mud patch plotting the revolution. Quote, "Somehow I can't imagine you in that situation," end quote, she said. Quote, "What? In a fitted tree? In a fitted tea?" End quote. Quote, "Huddled around a campfire, planning subversive pipeline demolitions," end quote. Quote, "Oh no, it's nothing like that. We don't discuss major actions at chapter meetings. The retreats are more like group therapy," end quote. Sophie pushed her 4 inches of ice into the corner of the table. Quote, "And now you're awfully quiet. May I ask what you're thinking?" End quote. Quote, "I'm thinking," said Laura, majorly tipsy, "I'm thinking it would be easy for me to despise your Luddite, hippie ways," end quote. Sophie cut in, quote, "We're not hippies. That's an important distinction. I must insist upon it. That would be like calling Lou Reed a hippie," end quote. Quote, "My mistake, my mistake. You're in the In Dreams Begin Responsibilities crowd. I get it. And on the one hand, it's easy for me to dismiss you. But on the other, and I mean this, it all sounds far too clandestine and exciting for you to be telling me about it," end quote. Quote, "Why is that?" End quote. Quote, "Because my life is boring. It's sad. I'm closed up tight in the extreme," end quote. Quote, "Is that true?" End quote. Quote, "Yeah, it is. What do the Marxists have to say about boredom and sadness?" End quote. Quote, "Well, for starters, they agree on very little. In an ideal world, the one we're all trying to bring about, probably none of us would ever have met one another in the first place. Who needs a headache?" End quote. Quote, "I think I may be living in that world," said Laura. "Hence the boredom," end quote. Quote, "Somehow I think we're living in the same world," said Sophie. "Hence the sadness," end quote. Suddenly, Sophie dropped her pensive expression. Quote, "I just remembered I have something incredible to tell you," end quote. Quote, "What is it?" end quote. Quote, "Bossus and Philemon are hooking up," end quote. Quote, "What?" exclaimed Laura. Then, bashful yet with boundless hope, added, Is it because they're married?" end quote. Quote, "No. Remember they introduced themselves to each other on set today? I dashed into the supply closet earlier, during that long break when Pierre announced he was going out to eat a donut experimentally. I was searching for coffee lids, and it turned out to be a pretty weird closet. It branched into a back stairwell, and I could hear moans coming from around the corner, then whispering, and what I can only describe as rustling. They removed their arm branches and were embracing freely, hands down, pants and everything. But they still had their enormous head canopies on, which forced them to get creative with the angles. In full costume and makeup, it was beautiful. To see them twisting around each other, sighing heavily, laughing, you could tell they thought it was hilarious, even though all that sexual energy. It was like the only living trees in the world had found each other. It was fate," end quote. These last words stayed with Laura long after she and other patrons had vanished one by one, and the bar had closed for the evening. On the train home, quote, "It was fate," end quote. Putting away the late-night salsa and chips, quote, "Fate," end quote. Alone in bed, she felt a long way from anyone else's romance, anyone's fate. Sleep eluded her. Recently, she had taken to prefacing stories about her recent past with, quote, "when I was young," end quote, in preparation for turning 31. It was a cruelty to herself. She knew that. But it was so hard to answer any of her own questions. And sometimes it felt better to believe the best of life was over. I believe no story about lusty 70-year-olds licking green dye off of each other's bodies would dislodge. Why find someone? Why lose them? Why does this pain last so long? Why this embrace and not that one? Why go on? Why fall in love with the world? Or just one person? Why die? Why change? The apartment felt dreadfully small. From her bed, she could see nearly all of it without turning her head. On her desk were the supplies laid out for her next day of work. Behind the closet door laid her old ambitions, entombed. In the kitchen, a modest window framed an assembly of stars anyone could see and invent stories about, beginning with their names. Harper's Magazine, March 2025. Underheading, Quandaries. Title, Early Modern Love. From, I humbly beg your speedy answer. Letters on Love and Marriage from the World's First Personal Advice Column, edited by Mary Beth Norton, which will be published next month by Princeton University Press. These entries originally appeared in the Athenian Mercury, a newspaper in London, between 1691 and 1694. Question. There are two ladies in love with me to the degree that nothing will satisfy them but marrying me. They both are content to take each other as a partner rather than lose me. Yet, fearing it's a sin, we know not what to do but will await your advice. Answer. 100 to 1 that you will not be liked as well after marriage as before, and it's probable you won't much like the prohibition of one woman or the other. Therefore, you'd better try them out first, and afterward let her take you that likes you best. Question. A lady of good birth and fortune has granted some private favors to me, but so discreetly as to preserve her reputation. A friend of mine courts her honorably and desires me to tell him my opinion of her virtue. How shall I behave? Answer. If by that expression some private favors be meant that everyone will suspect that reads the question, all the answer we'll give is, marry her quickly yourself, for until that's done, whatever fine names you put upon the matter, you're a blank and she's a blank. Question. I have long continued in a very vicious course of living, rendering myself incapable of resisting any temptation. First, I was guilty of excessive drinking, led to all other mischiefs. It is my misfortune to have contracted too great a familiarity with a woman who endeavors chiefly to seduce me and diligently uses her insinuating charms and deluding stratagems. Thus, I commit what is afterward the abhorrence of my soul, knowing that while I embrace her in my arms, I'm only embracing my ruin. How shall I disengage myself? Answer. That fornication is damnable without repentance is believed by all papists and atheists, and it's plain there is no repentance without amendment. We expect no amendment while you are near her. You ought to flee the fair destroyer, though it were to the ends of the earth. Harper's Magazine, March 2025, under the heading Dictation, titled Dream State, from Reports of Dreams Collected in The Third Reich of Dreams by Charlotte Verratt, a new translation of which will be published next month by the Princeton University Press. Verratt gathered the reports in Germany in the 30s, translated from the German by Damien Searles. Heading, A Woman. Every night without fail I try to tear the swastika off the Nazi flag. I'm proud of myself and happy when I do it, but the next day it's always sewn firmly on again. Heading, A Math Teacher. It was forbidden under penalty of death to write down anything to do with math. I took refuge in a bar. I took an extremely thin sheet of paper out of my bag and wrote down a couple of equations in invisible ink, deathly afraid. Heading, A Factory Owner. Goebbels came to my factory. He had all the employees line up in two rows, left and right, and I had to stand between the rows and give a Nazi salute. It took me half an hour to get my arm raised, millimeter by millimeter. Goebbels watched my efforts like a play, without any sign of appreciation or displeasure. But when I finally had my arm up, he spoke five words, quote, I don't want your salute, end quote. Then he turned around and walked to the door. So there I was, in my own factory, among my own people, pilloried with my arm raised. Heading, A Woman. I often dream about Hitler. He wants something from me, and I don't say, quote, but I'm a respectable woman, end quote. Instead I say, quote, but I'm not a Nazi, end quote. And that makes him like me even more. Heading, An Eye Doctor. I was summoned to treat Hitler because I was the only one in the world who could. I was proud of myself for that and felt so ashamed of my pride that I started crying. Heading, A Man. I dreamed that I had stopped dreaming about everything except rectangles, triangles, and octagons, which all looked like Christmas cookies, because we weren't allowed to dream. Harper's Magazine, April 2025, under the heading Epistle. Title, Heavens? No. By Deborah Eisenberg, from Issue 11 of Deadlines and Divine Distractions, which was published in December. Dearest, if I may, do, and here I'm charitably speculating, that my previous letters have for some reason not reached you, and that you have not already definitely done so, ignore what could be seen as pleas for help. All good, all fine, adjustments have been made. Your people pointed out, none too affectionately, that if I was actually in an effing despair, I could take the other option. Well, what might that mean exactly? A certain tone does not escape me. You've observed that the list of things I don't believe in is long. So true. And one of the things I don't believe in is heaven. Or does one say heaven with a capital H? There's so much I've forgotten. But why should I wonder? Aside from being deeply improbable, the concept, expressed by the word or words, or enduring bit of jargon, whatever you call it, is so vague, so candidly symbolic, so slobbily abstract as to offend one's sense of dignity, n'est-ce pas? To be honest, I can't imagine how anybody at all, aside from the exceptionally entitled or exceptionally deprived, can subscribe to such a notion. It's an effort just to imagine imagining it. Heaven, or heaven with a capital H, the word words suggests a home for the overage and the overwealthy, utterly sterile, institutional, the pompous authorities, a bit, how can I put it, lifeless? A joke. If I could imagine a heaven or a heaven with a capital, no doubt it would feature little moons, hedgehogs, some very good music, birds and flowers, and so on. No financial sector, you, and other delightful elements that I don't quite have the energy to enumerate here. In case my previous letters have not in fact reached you, I'll just say that they, possibly rather frequently, have mentioned that the dog took off some months ago. I don't know why. Some things just don't work out. And that my phone number is still the same. Likewise, my address, my email, and so on. If I have anything to apologize for, I apologize. And for what it's worth, in case it's not clear, I think of you with something like special human feelings. I think of you. Harper's Magazine, April 2025. Under the heading, Accounts, titled, Homefront. From interviews given to a researcher by six Ukrainian women in May and June of last year and provided to Harper's Magazine. The researcher's identity has been withheld to protect the woman's safety. Number one. I'm from Kharkiv, a big industrial center in eastern Ukraine. It had been transformed in recent years, before the war. That means good roads, flower beds, lovely parks. It's beautiful. It hurts me to know that missiles land in different parts of the city and people die. The people of Kharkiv are very tired. They've lived through war for more than 2 years. Kharkiv has filled up with people who came from small towns that were right in the line of military action. We are very close to the stations that launch missiles, so sometimes the missiles arrive first and only then does the siren go off. No one pays attention to it anymore. People sitting in cafes keep on sitting there. People going to work keep on going to work. It is not normal for any ordinary person not to fear an explosion. People should live in peace, should develop, should go to work, should produce some products, should rest, should bring up children. Many of our children do not go to school because there are so many destroyed schools. In addition, it is scary to send a child to school. There are only a few schools that have good bomb shelters where children study. They have even set up classrooms in the metro. Inside the subway, the passageway from one station to another is now taken up with desks. It's mostly older people, women, and children who ride the metro. There are very few men. It is very rare to meet a man of draft age. Recruiters go around all the places where you might meet people handing out notices. Markets, stores, parking lots, parks, subways, buses, bus stations. These are all places where they can hand you a draft notice. Men are in the most powerless position because the only thing they're allowed to do is to go to war. Number two. My friend sent me a photograph showing a vehicle belonging to the Army Recruitment Division stopping cars and dragging out the men and taking them away. This is done by force. We call it, quote, stealing people, end quote. Women try to beat them back. Mothers come to the enlistment center to get their sons. They make scenes. They fight. It's led to such consequences. Attacking the military personnel who are defending us, thinking that they work for the enlistment centers. These are horrible things. I know of a situation in which a student was asked by his teacher to come in earlier. This boy was always late. He was always getting yelled at. But this time his mother got him organized and said, quote, go, at least you'll be on time for once, end quote. He went, they took him to war, and he was dead a week later. I don't think it will happen in the big cities, but it happens in the small towns because they are less able to stand up for themselves. They are more subordinate to the authority of men in uniforms than city dwellers. The trouble is that some small towns already have no men left, and they have very many cemeteries, and the cemeteries are full. We visited schools near the front line. In those areas where the line went right through a town, we had to go with the children because they were afraid to go to school. They were afraid of the military, afraid of the airstrikes. We simply talked with the little kids. One time, we arrived at a school, and the head teacher, who loved us and always waited for us to come and talk with the kids, was in a very bad psychological state herself. We talked with her and learned what was wrong. The day before, there was a big airstrike in the center of town. They saw it hit a house. She and her husband ran over to see if anyone was alive in the house, if they could help. As she was running, something squished under her foot. She shone her flashlight on it and saw that she had run atop the remains of her old schoolmate. One minute, she had been talking with friends, and the next, she ran over the body of a friend she had known since childhood and had just been talking to. Just the thought was horrifying. This woman came to the school the next day to help us organize help for the children. But who was there to help her? Number four. If there is a man at war in a family, that adds a burden on women. Every day is filled with fear that there will be bad news. They live under regular air raids and experience extreme emotional tension, fear, and trauma. I often think about how women will have to restore Ukraine because we are losing men. But women are so exhausted now that they may not have the strength. Of course, there are also women whose men are not fighting. They hide these men at home, afraid they will be drafted. The social roles change. Before, the man was the breadwinner, and the woman ran the house. Now women must go to work. There are cases in which women are forced to have a third child because men with three children are not drafted. The war leaves a mark on the behavior and emotional state of people, and violence can appear in families where it had not existed before. Teenagers, especially girls, are more vulnerable, especially in low-income families that live near military bases. Number 5. There used to be an online map that showed strikes and destruction in Luhansk. One night, when I was away, I couldn't sleep, and I kept a tablet under my pillow, on which I kept checking the situation. Suddenly, I saw a strike right next door to my address. I kept trying to call my father and couldn't reach him. For a few days, I thought I would lose my mind. And then my father called. His voice was cheerful, and I said, quote, "Papa, how are you there? What's going on?" End quote. He said, quote, "I'm in Troposki," end quote. That's a village not far from Luhansk. He said that there was so much shelling that it was impossible to stay at home. The house that was hit next door was where a babushka lived. I said, quote, "How is she?" end quote. He said, quote, "She had made some soup and took it over to an ailing neighbor, and that saved her," end quote. It was a miracle. Number 6. War changes people. People who should not have killed and were not born to kill have a completely different view now after the war. I find it very hard to look them in the eye. I want to go back to the life I had before, but it's not like that and will never be like that again, so I don't know. Yesterday, my friend asked me what my plans are for the next couple of years, and I realized that I don't know how to make plans. It's enough for me that I have a plan at least for a week, for a month. This is the distance in time that I can control, I can keep, and I can manage, because everything beyond that is hard to predict. I have acquaintances who are still filled with hope, but I think my only hope is that we do not die of hatred.